Hello, everyone. Welcome back. This is Chander in Palo Alto.
And hi, everyone. This is Arne in Oslo.
You're listening to Valley Nordic, a podcast about business, culture, and technology from two perspectives, Silicon Valley and Nordic. And special welcome to new listeners. And today's topic is management. So Arne and I thought we've been talking about big picture or more what's happening in the market topics. Let's talk about
topics. Even what's happening in the world.
Yes. Yeah. I think last one was more what's happening in the world. And because many of our listeners are founders, and entrepreneurs and people who work at startups. So we thought we'd cover something that they see day to day.
Yeah, and management is a topic you've even been thinking about and writing about, huh? And even come up with a framework. So yeah. You're approaching my boxy world in a way.
I didn't like all the boxes that existed for it, so I created a new one. How's that?
You made circular boxes.
I made a circle out of the box. So Arne is referring to the image I have. So this is the theory or framework I published in Forbes, I think 3 years ago or 2 years ago, a while ago. It has a circle which shows four prongs or dimensions of management.
Did we mention that this? We also cover innovation in this podcast. So circular boxes is something new.
Finally, we solved a big mathematical problem. You know, it's a big problem in mathematics. How do you make box a circle? We can't. But now, with our creativity, we did.
Yep.
So that's what we'll talk about today, management in general. And I think I've been lucky or fortunate to work in companies of different sizes, started my own. I think the biggest company I worked with had 500,000 people. The smallest one that we started with two people, then it goes up to, you know, 20 or more. And then the startups I worked at had, you know, 50 people, 100 people. So I've seen it from all different perspectives. And I think maybe I didn't study anything in MBA, but I didn't find whatever I had learned from literature wasn't as applicable to how things actually work. And I would say what influenced me is my complex studies or complex system studies, where I learned about the history of how people get organized. So going back to how people are organized, I think first time that happened at a scale was in military. So when, you know, kings or whoever was running a region, people were organized at scale. In military, that was the first time. And through that, over time, certain set of principles developed how do you manage people at scale. And I think the key ones were hierarchy. So you organize people in a hierarchy. So, you know, I think we are all familiar with org charts. That's a hierarchy. Second was command and control. So basically you command people, tell them what to do, and you observe what they do. And you control what they do and not do. Then third is incentives for achieving goals and incentives of work. You know, one incentive is salary. Other is when you achieve the goal, you get rewarded for it. And fourth, I would say, is division of labor or responsibility based on function, which you still see today. Most of the companies you have, you know, CEO, then the head of product, head of marketing, finance, HR, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think fifth one is centralized decision making. So somebody at the top is making all the important decisions, which I think lower you go in the hierarchy, you can still make decisions, but they're more limited in scope. So that's how, you know, the basically people have learned to work together at scale. And if you think about how most companies are organized, not much has changed. Most of it is, I would say almost all of it is hierarchical. There's still, to some extent, command and control, but I think it's delegated down, depending on if you're running a business within a company. There are incentives for achieving goals. You get RSUs or options or, you know, bonus. And then there's division of responsibility, of course. And then centralized decision making, I would say, it's for big decisions, it's still there. But for, I think, smaller decisions, it has been pushed down to lower levels. What do you think, Arne, of the
overall? No, so I think this makes a lot of sense. And you draw, like, the long historical parallels that it's been static since it was essentially institutionalized in the military. And I would tend to agree with you a lot on most of these. The one I'm wondering about is the incentives for achieving goals.
Mm-hmm.
I think potentially that dimension is the one that maybe have changed most over the years. Mm-hmm. At least my perception is. So obviously I didn't live in the Middle Ages or something like
medieval
times. but my perspective was that maybe the weight was more at command and control and less on incentives in the olden days, or to the extent there were incentives, it was like avoiding getting killed or avoiding being beaten by a stick kind of thing, rather than so the stick, to the sense there was in the sense that there were incentives, it's more stick incentives than the carrot incentives it back in the day.
Yeah, you're probably right. And there were more wars during that time. So I think plunder was the big incentive if you won.
Right.
But win the war, then you can basically, you know, take whatever. But I think I agree with you. From military, from Middle Ages to today, there's less of a stake and more of carrot now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so we're moving to a more modern way of thinking about it. And obviously you've been thinking about it, and you also have the more active operating experience than I have. And so I'll let you lead the way, because, you know, there's enough investors who think they know operating better than founders. And that's where I will draw my limitation and say, you know, being an investor is working with founders and operators, but mostly about capital allocation and working in a very small and slim organization. So I guess you will lead the way and I'll pitch in as we go along here.
Yeah, we can also, I think, talk about how, you know, you make decisions within a venture firm, because it's not a typical company where it's hierarchical and command and control. You're basically allocating capital.
Yeah.
I think how I think about it as the CEO of a company, the main job is capital or resource allocation internally. What a VC does is spread over a lot of companies, but a CEO does is what happens within the organization. Like, you know, how many people do we need in marketing or resources, in development, in sales, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of at the highest level, that's what the idea is for the CEO to do internal resource allocation, understand risk with the goal of, you know, maximize shareholder returns and growth depending on wherever you are, but in the end, shareholder returns. But I think it gets more nuanced if you're in the middle of up and down, you know, like if you're not the CEO and you are not the individual contributor, if you're in the middle managing people, then it's much more nuanced on how you manage people.
Okay. Yeah, and I think the difference, if I should take the venture capital perspective on this, if you have an operating business, yes, it's allocation of resources, but your resources might be cash. Yeah. There are people and skills and other types of assets, maybe, you know, IP or machinery or whatnot, right? Yeah. And so that's a relatively complex structure. I'm not saying that venture capital necessarily is an easy game, but the resource allocation you're doing is mostly money. So it's a more one-dimensional resource that you're allocating.
Yeah, you're right. It's much more complex internally because you're dealing with people. You're dealing with money, which is easier. Okay, so how I thought about it was, you know, there are four dimensions to management. One is domain management. Second is organizational. Third is perception. And fourth is feeling. So what does that mean? So let's take them one by one. So domain means, let's say you are VP of product or VP of marketing or director manager of marketing, anywhere in the middle of, individual contributor and CEO, you have a function or role in the organization. So this is your domain or function you're responsible for. And as we discussed earlier, most companies are, organized in a way where different people perform different functions. So that function is the domain here. And I find it quite funny how, I have an MBA and I think Arne does as well. Yeah?
Yeah.
So we didn't take a course called business, and we are both masters of business. So how the world works is, we took different classes on, say, finance, strategy, marketing, etc. So the idea is, if you understand all these different functions or domains, then you understand the entire business. It's what's generally called linear thinking. If you want to understand something, you divide it into small parts, understand each part, and that gives you understanding of the whole. So here, what I see happens is, people generally go up in a domain. So let's say you start in marketing, you as a manager, then you become senior manager, then director, senior director, VP, SVP. So you're always staying in a domain you started in or you're interested in. And that's how you go up in the hierarchy. And generally in that, and that's how actually most of the people go up in, and people, when they hire people, they're looking for, somebody who has been doing marketing for 10 years or 15 years. But what I see happens is you have a pretty good idea after 10 years, what works, what doesn't work. You become less open to new things. That's why you see a lot of these innovations come out of, new companies, startups, because people are just so used to doing things in a way and they think they understand. So with time, the learning declines because you start thinking, you know it all. And that's why you see in many, like all domains, the newness or the innovation comes out of outside of existing infrastructure. So that's the domain management side. And as a manager, you have to have a general idea of whatever your function is so that you can guide people and coach them. Anything you want to add in domain management, Arne?
No, I think this makes a lot of sense. We talk about domain, but also function. In my head, when you say domain, I hear function, and therefore in my head, it's a synonym. Is there a nuance here, or is it exactly the same?
No, it is the same.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think, and this is more Because I have feelings management, that's FM. If I made that function management, then FM. So I had to be creative in coming up with an acronym that's different. So there.
Okay, well,
fair
enough. In my mind, though, this domain or function is a fairly classical way of thinking about management.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what they teach you in business schools. And that's why you see this whole like growth marketing tactics, that's all new, that's come up in Silicon Valley mainly. And it's, you know, I'll get into a deep hole if I start talking about it. So maybe we better move on. But you agree with my hypothesis?
Absolutely.
Okay. Then second is organizational management. Or OM. So I think there's so much talk about leadership in the business world. Everybody, you go on LinkedIn, everybody's a leader. And, you know, for a while I changed my title on LinkedIn follower because I got, if everybody's a leader, there's got to be a demand for followers. Who is following? But I think people didn't find it as funny as I did. So I changed it. But anyway, so when people talk about leadership, this is what they mean is organizational management. How are you able to align different people within the organization to, you know, achieve results if you have a P&L or any results you want to achieve? So how do you do that? So you have to set up a vision for what you want to achieve in the organization. Come up with incentives, you know, how people will be incentivized, and then convert, you know, mix, come up with goals for each individual in the org and have incentives aligned. So everything's moving towards the vision while people are meeting goals towards the shared vision. And that is very, let's say, the general feeling is in the industry, it's a debate. Some people are leaders and some are not. It's a learned skill or it's acquired, et cetera, et cetera. My view is, you know, I think anybody can be good at these things. You have to understand the concept. You have to see what motivates people. You have to make sure the vision is shared and people are incentivized for meeting goals. This is what we were discussing earlier, the carrot part, which has become much more important. Okay, Arne, your thoughts?
Yeah, so the components that you describe here is all, you know, about setting vision and also the goals and so directing how work is. But oftentimes when I hear organizational management, in my mind, it's also about structure or hierarchy, which we talked about before, but before we got to like this framework, do you see that fitting into this box or this part of your model or where does that fit in?
Yeah, it fits in here. So it's how are you organizing your people in your org? So let's say I had a large team at National Semiconductor. So how do you organize people in your team? How many hardware people you get? Who reports to who? How many times do you have, you know, team meetings? What are their goals? What are the incentives? So all those things fall here. The hierarchy happens here also.
Okay. Yeah. See that. And I, you know, it has to be done somewhere. You know, how do we organize ourselves? Not only to set the goals and incentivize, but you also have to structure it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another comment on this is you touch on the leadership element. Mm-hmm. And I guess the follower point I actually found quite funny, but you know, you're putting it you know, leadership under a management model, one of the big topics that has been discussed over the last 10 or, I don't know, 20 years is leadership versus management. Mm-hmm. And during that period of discussing these two things, the leadership has been glorified and management has been received negative connotations, in the sense that people think about leadership as much more inspiring, whereas management is negative in the sense that it's perceived to be micromanagement, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be that way, but they're related concepts and it depends on what you put in these concepts.
Yeah. I think from my view, it's just made up by consultants to make money, leadership versus management. It's when you read that literature, what they are referring to is what's under organizational management here. How you do it is tricky. Of course, there's some art to it. Everybody has a different way of doing it. But the concepts of, you know, having, creating a shared vision that people have bought onto, converting that into, you know, yearly, quarterly goals, and incentivizing people to meet that, that doesn't really change.
And I have to say, though, that, like, when you take what you put in the two buckets or sectors or whatever called domain and organization, mm-hmm. The concepts you put in these buckets are pretty, in my mind, classical topics under management.
Yeah, you're right. And I think this whole, you know, we have an MBA, so I encourage people to read this, anything they can find from Peter Drucker. And he's the one who came up with this idea of management and the idea of an MBA that this can be taught. So it all goes to Peter Drucker. I think none of it here is new or original thinking that I came up with. Well, the framing is my thinking. The actual concepts exist like for decades or, you know, centuries, not even decades. One common thing I see in big companies is, you know, there's often a reorg, and companies like pivot or change direction, and nobody tells employees what are they supposed to do differently. How do their incentives change? So I find that very amusing. And then second, sometimes the vision is declared, the new vision, then the goals don't change. So then people, you know, are confused. What are they supposed to do? So I find that quite funny that the basic things are not done by leaders or managers. Another common thing I see in Silicon Valley is everybody likes saying, oh, we are non-hierarchical organization. And sometimes they say that with the org chart in the background, where FP, who's reporting to you, is shown. So I find that funny. They're all hierarchical, but it's to the extent how much of the decision can you make that changes, but it's not a non-hierarchical organization. Okay, shall we go to the next one?
Well, I guess, though, I mean, there's a difference in how many levels of the hierarchy you have. So some organizations are more or less flat.
Like, tell me who is flat. Like, in operating organization, I think VCs, et cetera, they are pretty flat.
Yeah, definitely. Now, a VC firm is typically not an operating company, but in Silicon Valley, let's take Apple as an example. Mm-hmm. Probably more command and control, and probably more layers in the hierarchy than a Google. I'm not saying that Google is flat, because it's not, but it is probably less layers and slightly more autonomy?
I don't know. But they, I mean, it doesn't matter if one has 7 layer versus 8 layers. And Apple probably has more people than Google too. So things change with scale. Like, you know, you see, like at Ever, I think we got to 20 people and there were no layers. Everybody was reporting to me. But if, let's say, when you go to 50-100 people, then it's hard for everybody to report to one person, then you have layers. So I think it also changes with size, how many people you can manage.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, third is perception management. So first one was DM or domain management, second OM, this is PM. This is quite tricky, which I think I had to learn because my training or how I thought the world works is you do a good job and people automatically see it. But generally bigger companies don't operate that way. And a lot of them have, you know, so well, first what it means. It basically means how are you perceived by your team, so people who report to you, and people, your peers, and people above you, meaning your superiors. So how much, and what I have noticed, how much time you spend in perception management, it totally depends on the size of the company. As a startup founder CEO, you don't have to spend much time in perception management with your team because everybody sees the work. It's small. You may have to do some perception management with the investors. And here it's not a, you know, like a negative thing, perception management. It's more of making people aware and how you're being perceived and what people say about you in your absence. So in most big companies now, you have 360 degree reviews, etc., where your peers, you know, review your not performance, but how you are to work with. And in smaller companies, it's like as a person in middle management, people have to like working with you. They have to, you know, see that they are growing, they're learning things, having fun, and they're achieving results. So how you convey that to other people so that when the discussions are happening about you and you're not there, what are they going to say? So that's the idea of perception management. Like, how do you make sure? What that means is you have to then, you know, keep everybody up to speed on what's happening, share accomplishments, shared learnings, have maybe reports or more meetings, more, you know, alignment with different teams. Your thoughts, Aaron?
Yeah, so I have quite a few thoughts on this one. The first thought is that seeing this as a core dimension of management to some degree is an exotic idea to me, because it's not a bucket that I've been thinking about or has been in the, you know, the books I had at my MBA. That doesn't mean I disagree necessarily, but it's a different framing. Mm-hmm. And it could be viewed both very negatively and positively. Mm-hmm. So when I say it can be viewed very negatively, is that there's something called performance and there's something called perception. Mm-hmm. And hopefully perception should be something that reflects performance in some way. And if the distance between perception and performance gets to be too big, it's a negative thing, right? Yeah. And then you go into being delusional and you go into playing politics rather than actually performance So there's a very negative element of it if you play perception management too hard, in a way. And that feels, at least as a very non-Nordic quality, that I would be deeply suspicious about. But there's also a very positive angle. I mean, as I said, there's also something that's very classical, you know, the 360s you talk about here, in my mind, is more sort of performance management and is a well-known entity to me. And when I say there's a positive element to it, is perception management is also, in the way that you frame it, just being a communicator, a good communicator and a champion. I think actually a responsibility for whether you call it a leader or a manager is to be a good communicator, to align people. And it's to be a champion of whatever responsibility you have, whether that's your team or your function or whatnot, because that's your way of managing the relationships with the rest of the business or with customers or whatnot, which is a needed and positive thing. So I guess my view on this depends on how far the perception is removed from reality.
Yeah, I think in bigger, let's say large organization, it can be very far removed from reality, because you know, there's so many people. And also where it is negative is when there is no clear P&L, profit and loss responsibility within the org. So then what happens is, like, how do you measure performance results? Because there's no clear idea what are you supposed to deliver, and how do you measure that delivery? So then what happens is, it becomes, you know, peer review contest. Whoever is popular with the peers is considered good and gets to keep the job or get promoted. But whoever is not popular, him or she may be doing what's best. But if it's not perceived well, then, or it threatens the status of other people, you know, let's say you are in an org which is doing physical retail, and you say, well, we should do e-commerce because of, you know, there are 20 reasons. And then it affects their, you know, livelihood, or they may not perceive you as what's good for the org because they're focused on their incentives. They may lose their job if the company moves to e-commerce. So it's, I think in big orgs, there could be a wide gap between perception and reality. But in smaller orgs, generally there isn't, because startups, everybody knows, you talk to them every day. And it is so, you know, you're burning cash. Like, it's more clear what you're responsible for. All big companies have a lot of departments where nobody knows what they do or what they're supposed to deliver.
Yeah, no, I think we're actually aligned. By the way, I like the one, we should do e-commerce. Well, you know, there's 20 reasons, you know, we don't even need to discuss it. It's a funny statement, not to sidetrack. But I think, like, in my mind, is if perception management, the closer perception is a synonym to politics, mm-hmm. In my mind, it's a negative, and actually, I think politics in organizations, big or small, is generally a pest. And it's actually one of the reasons why small companies can win against big companies. Yeah. The closer to perception is to good communication, I'm all in favor of it.
Yeah, I mean, we are not making like a moral judgment, it's good or bad. I'm saying this is how it is.
Yeah.
People, this matters. And if you are a middle manager, you have to think about it, because it's happening anyways, you like it or not. And I mean, I'm amazed. This is just my personal experience. How much time is spent on PowerPoint, like the font size, because people think if I have a typo, I will be perceived as I don't pay attention to detail. And one good example there is Jeff Bezos saw that. And so he banned all color and graphics in PowerPoint. All PowerPoint had to be black and white and text, which I thought was a brilliant idea, because I've been in meetings where you spent hours polishing the PowerPoint.
This is true, but if you everything your company stands for is Times New Roman size 12, mm-hmm. your perception is also being from the last century.
How do you mean? Say more.
You know, just the most boring font there is, and there's never any fresh ideas.
Ah, but you know, you can express fresh ideas in Times New Roman. But it's all, I think, people try to become, or companies, in some companies, I've gotten, you know, like a 40-page document on the company fonts, what you can use when. So do these things really matter? I mean, somebody probably spent a year writing that doc. I mean, it's insane, but.
I think there's a context for everything, but, you know, fonts can impact click-through rates and conversion and all sorts of things. So I think they're, you know, focusing on the right things in the right context.
Yeah. I mean, if the font is on the website, then of course you have to do market research and what creates higher CTR, et cetera. Of course, all that is part of running the business. Here, you know, for internal communication, on the internal PowerPoint, which font you use, that's what I'm talking about. And that's what Bezos said, not like, I think they do a lot of testing externally.
All right, let's go for the last dimension.
Okay, the last is feelings management, that's FM. So what this means is, you know, like no matter, you know, what your role is or how good you are at management, eventually you'll end up hurting somebody's feeling. And you may remember, well, you may not, it was a while ago, that one of the trends we highlighted was younger people are more feeling conscious than older people. So you have to, and you know, people have to feel good about working with you and feel good about the shared vision. And if you do anything bold or controversial, you have to do it tactfully. Like the example we were talking about, e-commerce versus, you know, physical retail. You can just say, yeah, I mean, the future is e-commerce. We should get out of physical retail. Then people won't like it. Or you can be more tactful in, okay, is there, can we differentiate with omnichannel? Let's discuss the options, et cetera, et cetera. So it's how you deal with other people's feelings as they relate to, you know, your vision and work and what you're trying to achieve as a middle manager. In what I found in my experience, it's easier to critique someone's work or give feedback in to engineers if they are, you know, if you can give a logical explanation. But it's much harder for people in the creative fields, like, you know, let's say a graphic artist or a designer, because they're very proud of their work, they take it more personally, and you can't really say, give logic. Let's say I see some, you know, I ask somebody to visualize an idea and I don't like it. I can't give a logical explanation why I don't like it. Sometimes I can, sometimes I cannot. So you have to do it more tactfully and thoughtfully so that you're not hurting people's feelings and people are feeling good about working with you and contributing to the vision. Okay, what do you think, Arna?
Oh, come on, engineers have feelings too.
That's fine. Yeah. But
seriously, you're obviously onto something in terms of the core idea here. Once again, it feels sort of slightly exotic as a main dimension of management.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to what I've been trained for, but I don't disagree with the point. I think it's sort of closely related to some other concepts that we've talked about here, this is also about communication, which I think is a core skill for management essentially, and it's also related to another concept that is often talked about, which is sort of the stakeholder management, right? Building relationships and understanding how you can align people with different perspectives and ways of thinking to essentially make the overall organization work better. So I think while I see it as kind of like an original framing, it's not completely foreign to something that I've seen working before.
Yeah. So like I was saying earlier, this is how I've seen it. It's not something abstract. This is how I see it works in the business world, in organizations I've been part of. So all this is based on my firsthand experience. And it's like, for example, at National Semiconductor, it's very was heavy tech company, so mostly engineers, so I didn't have to worry so much about feelings management. But Ever, which was a startup I co-founded, I had to work with a lot of people in LA, and we had a lot of younger people, so I had to become better at it, at feelings management. Like a good example is in how my training was, if your boss or somebody doesn't say anything, you have annual review, and that's when you find out. But if you don't hear anything, that means you're doing a good job. Like the default is you're doing a good job if you don't hear anything. But now the default is if people don't hear anything, then they think it's bad job. So you have to provide constant reinforcement that people are doing a good job. So I see that as a big shift in the FM domain over the last 10, 15 years. And it was considered inappropriate if you sent an emoji to your boss, but now it's a common thing. So there's more expression of feeling. So can we talk? I think those are the four domains, and I think what I would add is so it depends, the size of your org, where you are in the hierarchy, how much DM, OM, PM you have to do. But you have to do all of them in parallel. So how much of this you do is all depends on your role, where you are in the hierarchy, and how much, how much of your goals are concrete versus subjective. Okay, so can you share, Arne, how do you make decisions in a venture capital firm and how it's organized?
Yeah, so I think we'll start with the organization. So a traditional or classical venture capital firm is a partnership. Mm-hmm. And partnerships, you also know from law firms and some large consulting organizations. So the partners are, in a way, both the ones who run the show and also own the business. And it's a capital allocation game. And historically, a venture capital firm has been very sort of small organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the partners who make decisions about investments.
So how now this, like, wait, so you, let's say your firm has, you know, 10 partners. Can you, all of them have to agree? It's a consensus decision, or you can decide, you have like your own pot of money and you can invest wherever you want.
So this varies from firm to firm. I would also say that, you know, this is the classical way of setting it up. There's also always been like, historically also, you know, some venture firms had a lot of junior people on investment team who work deal flow, and some has been, you know, flatter and partner driven.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that varies from firm to firm, and sort of the newer trends, even if it's probably, I would say, 10-year old, is that venture firms have more operational staff, which could be supporting on sales and marketing, on recruitment, on making slide decks, if you like. So the ultimate example is sort of the, if you go to Silicon Valley, probably the most sort of classical flat partner-driven thing is Benchmark, high-profile partners and not a very large organization, which is maybe the, you know, the way that classical VC firm was done, whereas Andreessen Horowitz is now hundreds of employees, mm-hmm. whereas the investment team is probably, I don't know, 20%, 30% of that, mm-hmm. but with junior people and their investment partners. And then they have all the other operational support organization, which is actually bigger than an investment team. That's not the norm, but that happens. But if we assume we're talking about a traditional where investment operations is the main thing you do, mm-hmm. Whether you have junior team or not, it's the partners who make decisions. And the traditional way of doing that is that you have partner meetings on Mondays where you make decisions. They can happen off schedule as well, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then it varies from partnership to partnership, whether it's everything from individual partners can make their own decisions and investments,
mm-hmm.
to consensus in partnership. The consensus one is very unusual these days,
mm.
and probably have never been the driving force in Silicon Valley. You know, Nordics have been more historically consensus oriented than Silicon Valley in general, and which has also shown up in partnerships here. But very few partnerships are consensus oriented here. Or anywhere. But I would say like most partnership operates on some sort of minimum support in the partnership, which could be at least one other partner supporting or a majority decision or something like that. In our case, we typically operate on a majority decision or a majority not against approach.
So you can abstain, and
you know you can say I don't have particular feelings for this deal, but I'm happy to go along with it, right? Because some other partner is very passionate that this should be done, but you know, which means that even if you don't have a very strong opinion, you at least you don't try to vote it down, right?
Yeah. Okay. And thanks, Arne. Is there, like, I'm curious if there's some analysis done of how there are basically three models of decision making in the venture world. Like you mentioned, there's individuals make their own, partners make their own decision. They get their own pot of money. I think I read somewhere and Reason has that now. Then there is the majority model against or for, or basically more people. Actually, there are two different models. So let's say majority for, majority not against, but let's put them together, some kind of majority model. And third is consensus, which It may have changed, but I remember when I was new to Silicon Valley learning things, there were few firms which had the consensus model, and that basically everybody had a veto. So of these three types of decision-making models, which of the firms have higher returns? Like, that'll be an interesting analysis to see, because in the end, it's all about decision-making or to allocate capital. Which decision-making method gives you better returns?
Yeah, so I think there has been studies, and I can't say here's the reference to it or something like that, but it's a little bit noisy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's intransparent data.
Yeah.
And it's also so that there are a number of like hybrid models, right? Where individual partners can make decisions up to a certain threshold of value or, and then, you know, if it's a bigger deal, then you have some sort of majority or at least minimum support type of structure. So it's never as clear cut. I think the consensus one is going out of fashion.
Mm.
And I think data proves that is not a very efficient way of doing it, because it's been proven that some of the best investments in the world are very non-obvious and to some extent counterintuitive. If it was blatantly obvious, then everyone would do it and there would be too much competition, right? So some of the best investments have been sort of controversial or non-obvious.
Yeah.
And these things tend to be killed in a consensus model.
Yeah.
So some sort of non-consensus model, but risk mitigating, you know, still having some sort of check on what risks the firm takes,
mm-hmm.
I think is best practice. And I think, you know, also consensus firms tend to get bigger, right? And if Andreessen Horowitz had to have consensus and had to have 40 partners in the room, that would just, you know, be impossible, right? But so I think there are like a lot of developments on this. I think some people raise individual individual funds as a solo GP, and obviously they have.
Oh yeah, that's only,
there's only one vote, right? But typically, you know, the partnership as a group raises a fund,
mm-hmm.
and so it's one bucket of money. And you know, if you had like partners are in truth also different level of trigger happy,
mm-hmm.
and so. So if you sort of divided it into buckets, one partner might run entirely dry before the others have started, right? Or if you didn't have, like if you have individual decision making and one bucket, that partner might have spent the money for everyone, right? So I mean, this is why it's not often as clear cut that... There tends to be some sort of mechanism that it's not like full individual autonomy or but I think sort of a majority or a minimum threshold tends to be more normal, even if like smaller deals there's a reasonable degree of autonomy.
So it's thanks, Arno. I think it's
and then also there's like say you're Andreessen Horowitz, not that I've been to her partner meetings, but it's kind of like, let's say your investment partner number 40, you just arrived, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and let's say there was a huge deal. That new partner would probably seek alliances over getting a positive investment decision around that, right?
Yeah.
But say Mark Andreessen wants to make a $10 million investment. He doesn't ask anyone for that. He's telling the partnership, I'm doing this deal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully he still informs others. So let me add quickly two things. One, I see similarity in the operating companies versus venture firms. Things change with scale, how you manage. Second, yeah. I think your world is basically limited to domain management. Your domain is investing and you don't have to worry as much about you know, perception, organizational, or feelings.
You're probably right. That said, I mean, some of the discussions around deals can be heated.
Yeah, but it's mainly money. Of course, you're dealing with people, so you have to some level, think about other people's feelings. But, and there's clear, you know, results. Like what you invest, you will know for sure, rather than, oh, this marketing campaign, did it generate the amount of awareness we wanted? Wow.
And also, I would say, like, as a, at least if you're a partner level in a venture capital firm, even if you don't have like entirely full autonomy of all making investments at all deal sizes and so forth, your level of autonomy is much, much higher than 99% of the people in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I think, fun to be a VC. That's why you're always happy, Arne. But you want more happiness, I remember.
I don't know.
Okay.
I think people should try to be happy if they can, regardless of what they do.
And get happier.
Yeah.
So on that happy note, we should end. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.